Alex Jones, 4chan, the anti-vaxxers. Why are so many Americans getting radicalized by right-wing conspiracy theories? In other words, why are bad ideas so prominent?
I'm only left with the conclusion that the reason they become more prominent is because we are in this state of trauma, that we are in this point in which we don't really know whether a bridge is going to fall down or our water is going to poison us, or the research that our doctor cited to tell us that these opioids that she just prescribed are safe will turn out to have been expensively procured by evil billionaires. And in that world, I think radicalization comes easy.
That's science fiction novelist, blogger, and technology activist Cory Doctorow. We talk with him about his terrific new book, Radicalized. It brings together four sci-fi novellas connected by social, technological, and economic visions of today and what America could be in the very near future. Then we re-air an edited version of our 2010 interview with Doctorow about his novel Makers, which is about a movement of open-source tech creators and their battle with the Disney Corporation. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Cory Doctorow is one of the globe's leading thinkers about the internet and the digital commons. He has the blog Craphound, is the co-editor of the blog Boing Boing, has worked on and off with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and also finds time to write speculative fiction that's both entertaining and thought-provoking. Doctorow's latest fiction foray is Radicalized, a collection of four novellas set in the near future that aims a sharply honed lance of satire at today's political and social inequalities. It creates an all-too-real vision of the dystopian possibilities we're headed for. But it's also a celebration of the human impulse to break the chains of corporate control. We last spoke to Cory Doctorow about his novel Walk Away. Cory Doctorow, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back on.
We have talked with you before about your books, Makers and Walk Away, both of which I loved. But this one, Radicalized, is actually so far my favorite. It's four novellas of speculative fiction that seems so real because they stretch current reality just a little bit to reveal where we do seem to be going as a society. And they reveal the core of the sickness of our society, I think. And where does that sickness lie for you?
Well, I am leery to ascribe unitary causes to complex phenomena. And one of the things that I try to get at in this book is that there are a lot of things happening at the same time. And they interact with each other, and they feed off of each other, or they dampen each other. And I kind of feel like we need to tug on the end of the string and see if that loosens the knot a little. So I can give you some string ends that I perceive, and maybe if we tug on those, we will loosen the knot enough to reveal other entanglements further down. So for example, I think the big one is inequality. We're living in a moment that is more unequal than at any time since the Gilded Age. It's a level of inequality that surpasses France on the eve of the French Revolution. And one of the epiphenomena of inequality, one of the things that inequality kind of generates along the lines, is a kind of incoherence about what is and isn't true. Because as a smaller and smaller number of people get richer and richer, our ability to describe the factual nature of the universe becomes more and more contingent on not upsetting a rich person. And so, you know, a good example of that would be climate denial, right? There is clearly a business model for taking the already uncertain process of using science to determine the far-off impacts of complex interactions between climate and carbon and other gases. And because that relationship is complicated already, if you throw in just a little bit of expensively sown doubt, you can create a very long-term incoherent picture about what is and isn't true. But, you know, that is radiated into so many of our other truth-seeking exercises. And I think that when you live in a complex technological society, there's probably nothing less appreciated or more important than truth-seeking, right? Finding out whether or not the structural steel that's holding up your roof was adequate to the task, or whether the pesticides being used to grow your food are going to give you cancer, or whether vaccines are safe, or whether opioids are safe. I mean, these are all important factual questions that have some political valence, like, you know, we might ask ourselves if opioids are safe and then for whom they're safe. We might say, oh, well, you know, the harm mostly arises to the user of the opioid and therefore it's your own choice. Or we might say, oh, no, actually the harm redounds to their family and society and so they should get a look in too. But all of those exercises are increasingly cabined off by the inability to do or say things in official contexts that upset the donor class that keep our political machine running. And so this has produced a kind of reeling incoherence where we no longer agree not just on what is true, but we also no longer agree on how we can know whether a thing is true or not, right? We used to say a thing is true if the best evidence pointed to it, but now that we don't trust the evidence gathering processes, we say a thing is true if someone we think of as trustworthy tells us it is. And that creates these weird cults of personality where if you believe Alex Jones on one thing, you end up buying in to Alex Jones on all things, and you get this rise of conspiratorial thinking. And we tend to attribute that rise to the compelling speech of Alex Jones. But Alex Jones has been saying crazy things for a long time without his followership appreciably growing. What seems to have changed is not that Alex Jones got a lot better at delivering his message, but that we all became much more willing to believe that conspiracies existed, in part because we kept learning about conspiracies.
My rule of thumb is often to think about who does this benefit, you know, because I have a certain analysis of the power in society that conforms very much to what you write about in this book, Cory Doctorow, in Radicalized. But, you know, you're giving me a picture of maybe that's not always the only thing that can guide us. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that when we talk about how people get radicalized, when we talk about how people find themselves in believing bad things that then lead them to do bad things, we tend to place our focus on this contagion model where we say, oh, well, the reason you believe that terrible thing is you got really close to someone who believed the terrible thing and somehow they changed your mind. And people do change their minds. I'm a great believer that people change their minds through argument. That is like my whole, you know, belief system and theory of change for the world is that if we say true things and we make them plain and compelling enough that other people will see our truths. But again, there's very little to suggest that the people making the argument for the flat earth are more compelling now than they were 30 years ago. And if anything, they're less compelling because, you know, this is the age in which your kids' high school hackerspace can make a balloon that will sail a GoPro camera high enough to see the Earth's curvature, right? So there's never been a time when it was easier to debunk flat Earth. And so what we're left with is this kind of grasping around for why bad ideas seem to have become so prominent. And I'm only left with the conclusion that the reason they become more prominent is because we are in this state of trauma, that we are in this point in which we don't really know whether a bridge is going to fall down or our water is going to poison us, or the research that our doctor cited to tell us that these opioids that she just prescribed are safe will turn out to have been expensively procured by evil billionaires. And in that world, I think radicalization comes easy.
He goes looking for a place online, like so many of us do, and he discovers a website that we can't fully name on the radio, so let's just call it FCRIIF.
Right.
Tell us about that website and his complex and developing relationship to it.
So it's a website that, like so many websites, provides support to people who are going through tough things in their lives. And the inspiration for that website was the first incel website. Incels are a misogynist cult of now, I think, exclusively men who believe in a kind of elaborate conspiracy theory or bad science theory about evolutionary psychology that says that only certain kinds of men who have certain kinds of facial features and so on will get sex from the right kind of women. And they believe themselves to be the wrong kind of men and therefore unfairly deprived of the sex to which they're entitled. And famously, incels have committed a string of mass murders in the last 2 years. What's not well known about incels and what ties directly into the story is that the incel movement was inadvertently created by a queer Canadian woman who coined the term incel, involuntarily celibate, to describe her own loneliness and her own feelings of anxiety and inadequacy because she had not been able to find someone to be physically intimate with. That's a very hard place to be. And she started this message board, and she had this discussion with these people who came along to join her and discuss it. And one day she woke up, she had a realization that in most support communities, the elder states people are the people who got better. Right. If you're on a message board for people who struggle with alcoholism, the people who've been there the longest have been on the wagon the longest. And when you fall off the wagon, they're there to tell you it gets better. They're there to give you the benefit of their experience. But that the incel message board, for whatever reason, the only person left behind who'd gotten better was her. And the other people who were still hanging around on this message board after years and years were the people who were irredeemable, who were completely incapable of locating someone to love and whose bitterness had turned in on itself. And when there was a new member of this message board who was struggling with trauma and self-doubt, rather than being the sober voice of reflection and experience to say it gets better, they were there to say it only ever gets worse from here. And so the lead character of this story, Joe, he's on a message board for people whose loved ones are dying of cancer that could be cured, but whose insurers treat the cure as experimental, as a cost-saving measure, and who therefore have to watch the people they love best in the world die slow, lingering, unnecessary, painful deaths in order to enhance the profitability of an insurer. And in that toxic environment of trauma and of elder states people who know it never gets better, Joe finds himself surrounded by people who, when someone says, I don't know why someone doesn't just go shoot that healthcare executive, those people are saying, why don't you go shoot that healthcare executive? If you're going to kill yourself anyway, why don't you make it count? And even after his wife has a miraculous, spontaneous remission, Joe realizes this dynamic is underway and he decides he needs to stick around and try and save the community from itself.
This story features somebody who does begin to engage in terrorism. I know you don't condone this kind of violence, but the story has a kind of nuanced view of it. So I wonder if you could talk about that. I mean, one does kind of understand where it comes from, which is a very uncomfortable place for the reader to be.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, everyone who's ever cheered on a revolutionary struggle has to contend with the fact that not everyone who's on your side turns out in the final analysis to have been on the side of the angels. And I don't really care which side of any revolutionary struggle you're on, you have to contend with that. If you're cheering for Reagan as he's arming the Contras, you do need to make your peace with the fact that the Contras then tied American nuns to trees and bayoneted them after raping them, and that they were on your side and they were your good guys. You know, anyone who cheered on the struggle for self-determination in Ireland, anyone who watches Hamilton and cheers for the American revolutionaries has to contend with the fact that rights are never given, they're only taken, and that that process is messy. And that process also often involves people who, in the light of sober day, after the dust has settled and the dead have been buried, you look on them and you realize that they were not merely engaged in an excessive zeal, but that they were psychopaths or sociopaths who happened to be useful to your cause, but who you ultimately either have to disown or make peace with.
Wow, yeah. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Cory Doctorow about his latest book. It's a book of four novellas. It's called Radical Love. I think my favorite story, because it combines such appealing characters with a really sharp level of satire, and one that I completely relate to, and that is the first one, Unauthorized Bread. So tell us about that story.
You know, Unauthorized Bread, it's a story about people in refugee housing that in theory is a subsidized housing arrangement, but in practice it turns out the way that the subsidy is recouped for the developer who built the extra floors in their building in order to get a planning variance is that every appliance in every unit is designed to bleed every penny that you have out of you. So the toaster will only toast authorized bread, and the washing machine will wash authorized dishes, and the clothes washing machine will wash authorized laundry, and you have to buy all of your consumables from the company store. And, you know, in some ways, this is no different to, you know, the situation that people are in if you own an Apple phone, where you can only use Apple authorized software on your phone. And, you know, as a kind of hobbyist computer scientist, I have an honorary doctor in computer science, I'm here to tell you that your iPhone can run programs that Apple hasn't blessed. It just won't. It's not that it's incapable, it's that it's disobedient. And, you know, there is this bad technology adoption curve that I talk about in my political work, where when you have a terrible political idea, you have to first beta test it on people whose complaints don't get any airtime. People like refugees or just plain migrants or prisoners or kids or blue-collar workers, people in mental institutions, people on welfare. But over time, as you sand the rough edges off of it, and also importantly, as you normalize it, you eventually get to move it up the privilege gradient until everyone's using it. So, you know, 20 years ago, if you were eating your dinner and there was a closed circuit TV camera watching you, it was because you were in a supermax prison. And today, it's because you bought Google Home. And, you know, this is a story that uses that dynamic to try and put the kind of privileged people who are, to be honest, the largest audience for, you know, hardcover science fiction novels for major publishers, to make them think through where our technological destiny lies. Because we do live in that world, but also to think through how wonderful it is when we seize our own technological self-determination, when we seize the means of computation, as the characters in this book do. The companies that make these awful appliances, they're awful all the way through, including in their leadership, who are the kinds of financial shenaniganizers who like to take their companies through the odd occasional convenient bankruptcy to shed some debt and then restructure them. And during one of these restructurings and bankruptcies, all of their appliances stop working. And so they figure out how to jailbreak their appliances. And in that moment, realize that the problem with their appliances is not how they work, but who pushes the buttons, right? Whose finger is on the button? What not what it does, but who it does it for and who it does it to. And that moment of technological self-determination and exhilaration that so many people have experienced is quickly chased by a moment of growing horror as these companies restructure out of bankruptcy, and the people in the story realize that very soon they're going to switch on the telemetry that will rat them out for having jailbroken their appliances and will put them up in extreme legal jeopardy. You know, under the 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine to traffic in hacking tools to bypass these locks. And so they're facing the prospect of being deported back to countries they fled in fear of their lives, right? Their jailbreaking puts their very lives at risk.
Yeah, and this is a major theme in your work. You have long been involved in the issue of copyright law. You've been a great supporter and a great activist in the digital commons. We recently saw a book published, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which, you know, seems to make it pretty clear that we have gone way far down this road of both surveillance and the locking up of copyright. Talk about how this story and what it sees for the future. I mean, there is not just these dystopian elements in it, but there is also, as you reference, there is the fight back. Who's going to win? Who can win? Can we still win against this age of surveillance capitalism, this age of, you know, the locking up of intellectual property?
Yeah. Boy, there's a lot to unpack there. I'll start by saying that while I am very interested in the idea of a commons and of more equitable access to information, the real reason to care about copyright is that for reasons of historic accident, we've decided that the most applicable law to everything we do on the internet is entertainment law, copyright law. And I care about whether that's good law or bad law because I work in the entertainment industry, but almost nobody else works in the entertainment industry. And the idea that you have to be an expert in entertainment law to like read a news article, and you know, if you look at the EULA, the license agreement that goes with that news site that you're hanging out on, you know, empirically, it probably requires the same level of expertise and reading comprehension as a second year law textbook. That's the kind of median range for those things. That's just a silly idea, right? You know, the idea that because everything involves making copies, from dating websites to websites where we talk about politics to websites where we, you know, flirt with each other or get support for our rare diseases, because those all involve copying, that the first law that we reach to should be copyright, which is really just designed to mediate the affairs of people in this tiny little entertainment industry that I'm part of. It's ridiculous on its face, right? No one is ever going to make copyright simple enough for a kid to write Harry Potter fan fiction and land on the right side of it. And if they do, it won't be technical and sophisticated enough to allow Harry Potter to be licensed from Warner to Universal to build the Harry Potter fan theme park, right? So it's a kind of a nonsense. You mentioned surveillance capitalism, and you know, I am I think Zuboff, who wrote that book, Shoshana Zuboff, has her heart in the right place, but I actually take great exception with her thesis. So Zuboff's thesis, foundationally, is that machine learning is so good at convincing us of stuff that it actually subverts markets. That the reason the big tech companies are so concentrated and powerful is not because they are monopolists functioning in a world where for 40 years we've taken away anti-monopoly enforcement powers, but instead because machine learning convinces us of everything. And I don't think it's true. I think that it is true that we live in a moment of rising conspiratorial thinking, but I think that, again, is mostly attributable to monopoly and inequality, which are flip sides of the same coin. And I think that there's very little evidence that machine learning is as good at selling us stuff as the people who make it claim it is. In other words, Zuboff starts with what I think is the absolutely correct premise that big tech is totally untrustworthy, and that everything they say should be treated with great suspicion, and that they cheat like crazy on taxes, on employment law, on privacy, and on every other substantial way in which they interact with the world. But the place where she and I disagree is that she thinks that the one time we should take them at their word is when they're writing sales literature about how great their products are. And when Cambridge Analytica tells you that they can make normal people into Trump voters, that is the one time that they're telling the truth, and every other word out of their mouth is a lie. And I think, you know, I agree with Zuboff that every word out of their mouth is a lie, but I disagree with her because I think their sales literature is also full of rubbish. And so instead, you know, and the reason that's important in terms of answering your question is if you believe in technological self-determination, then it requires that you also be willing to say, well, Facebook doesn't have a mind control ray. They just have locked up all of our friends inside of a walled garden where everything we do is subject to their observation. And so they can make some pretty straightforward inferences. Like if you want to sell a refrigerator to someone, you look for people who've been reading refrigerator reviews. Or if you want to sell a racist demagogue to someone, you look for people who hang out with racist demagogues. And that, you know, most of the stuff that Zuboff says is evidence that tech can cause us to lose our free will is actually stuff that just as readily can be interpreted as showing that it doesn't, right? It is true that like a Google incubated company figured out how to get us all run around and look for Pokemon Go's for a couple of months, but then they stopped, right? Then like we all became inured to that stimulus in the same way that, you know, for a couple of months, everyone you knew was playing Farmville, and then that company never managed to repeat the feat. Most people got bored and walked away from it. And the company, despite having hundreds of millions of dollars in profits to develop the next Farmville that sucks us all in, although they made lots of other products, none of them were successful particularly. And so I think it's far more likely to say that big tech's market concentration makes it a danger to our species. But big tech's mind control ray is highly overrated.
Well, I tell you, you are giving me such hope, you know, and I think I agree with you, because I noticed the Google ads almost never actually appeal to me. So how much do they really know about me? And the other issue is, you know, the Cambridge Analytica is something that really I've been terrified about. I mean, given the coming election, and what you're really saying is that, you know, people are much quirkier than an algorithm can really actually suss out. Is that right?
Well, yes, but also, you know, maybe the reason people voted for a racist is that they're racists, right? And you know, that's not necessarily a comforting thought. But the thing that we've been sort of dancing around a little here is that we live in a very different world from the one that was around 40 years ago. It's a much more unequal world. And there are some pretty, like, bright lines that we can draw to how it got as unequal and as concentrated as it is. So, you know, in the Reagan era, that wasn't all just arming Contras to bayonet nuns. It was also dismantling antitrust law. In America prior to Reagan, it was generally prohibited for firms to snap up nascent competitors that they were worried would grow to be a threat to them someday. And large companies could not merge in a way that created monopolies or even, you know, highly concentrated markets. And firms that had key roles were subject to what was called structural separation. Like, banks couldn't loan money to businesses or couldn't start businesses that competed with the businesses they loaned money to, because those companies would have an unfair advantage. And today we look at Google and those other big tech giants, and we see that, you know, while maybe, like, they had the unique advantages of tech in some ways to grow big, network effects and so on, mostly when you try to analyze the factors that contributed to their concentration, they're just really straight ahead monopoly tactics. I mean, Google is a company that only developed two products, right? They developed a really good search engine and a pretty good clone of Hotmail. And everything else Google does, they do because they bought a company. They bought a company that they probably wouldn't have been allowed to buy 40 years ago. And so, you know, when we look around and say, well, why do people believe a demagogue who tells them the system is rigged? Maybe it's because the system is rigged. I mean, the demagogue isn't going to unrig it. If anything, he's going to rig it more. But the fact that he was willing to utter the unutterable truth that the system is rigged, you know, that America is not great, that America is only great if you're in the 1%, you know, and who would know better than he? That is an uncomfortable diagnosis, because it makes people who really believed in the neoliberal project and really believed that totally unregulated markets would regulate themselves and find the very best people in the world and make them very rich by way of rewarding them for doing so much that increases our general prosperity, actually just turns out to be a recipe for oligarchy, right? Actually, you know, it turns out that if you don't regulate markets, cheaters and sociopaths win. And so you hear these people trying to explain why it wasn't just capitalism that produced where we are today, but instead some special component of capitalism, network effects and mind control rays and so on. And it's like listening to someone who smoked all their life and now has lung cancer trying to explain to you that it wasn't the cigarettes, it was the environmental toxins that gave them it, you know, or what, you know, the reason that my unvaccinated kid has smallpox is not because I made the bad choice not to vaccinate them. It's because some terrible thing in our environment, in modern living, caused them to get smallpox. And I understand that kind of motivated reasoning. Goodness knows I'm as prone to it as the next person, but I think that it behooves us to point that out.
So three of the stories in this book, in Radicalized, Cory Doctorow, feature people who are in some way fighting back against the machine that is trying to control them, taking power back from unjust rulers, whether that be a tech company. We haven't talked about the model minority story, where the police injustice system are featured here, the health insurance industry. But in the last one, in The Mask of the Red Death, you pose two opposite responses to societal collapse. And this was kind of a theme that was also, I think, in your book, Walk Away. I wonder if you could talk about that story.
Yes, of course. So it's called The Mask of the Red Death. It's named for a very famous Edgar Allan Poe story. And as you say, it is kind of the inverse of the story Walkaway, of the novel Walkaway. Walkaway is a story that tries to counter the narrative convenience that when things go wrong, your neighbors are going to turn into ravening monsters who will come and eat you, which is, you know, a story we see all the time. You know, the minute the lights go out, your neighbor is revealed to have been a beast all along. And this is a story about someone who believes that. Not a story about it being true, but a story about what it means to go into a crisis firm in your belief that everyone except you is bestial in nature and is coming over to take your stuff and you know, put you in chains. And that is a belief that is pretty common among extremely privileged and wealthy people. In fact, there's a name for it. Sociologists call it the elite panic. And it's been around for a long time. It's why after the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, they wouldn't let poor people back into the mission to fight the fires that they accidentally set trying to build fire breaks, and why they burned down a quarter of San Francisco. They were convinced that the poor people who lived in the mission would go and loot if they were allowed back in to fight the fire in their neighborhood. And so their neighborhood burned down. That kind of elite panic, we see it in Katrina, and we see it in the Haiti earthquake, and we see it in lots of other places. And I wanted to dig into the mindset of being someone who knows that you have so much more than everyone else and who has come to the conclusion that most people are actually surplus to requirements, that with automation, we can just get rid of most people, that these underclasses, they're not even useful for suppressing the wages of their colleagues because, you know, by being the people standing around outside looking hungry who you can point to and say, you want a raise? Why don't I give your job to one of those guys? And instead, they're just like, they're disposable. And so in that disposable world, you get these would-be Ubermenschen who think that the apocalypse is actually kind of a good idea, that it's the thing that's going to separate the sheep from the goats. And all they need to do is go to ground in their luxury bunkers with their thumb drives full of Bitcoin and their gemstone quality precious stones and their massive arsenals of automatic weapons. And when the dust settles, when other people, lesser people, have managed to rebuild civilization outside the walls, they can just emerge and take their rightful places, you know, as a kind of Frazetta painting overlord with, you know, a harem and a pile of treasure and a you know, well-armed militia around them to defend what they got. And about just how bankrupt that plan is. And about how, like, any plan to restart civilization has to start with full employment for everyone, burying the dead, getting the sanitation working, and doing all the messy business of ensuring that we all don't die of cholera. Because I don't care how tough you are, you cannot shoot germs.
Yeah, and that was another one of my favorite stories. You know, it would have been so easy to go down a dystopian road, but I found a lot of hope in these stories, a real sense of how, you know, we get the story that everything is going to crap. But you point out that we have an enormous amount of human ingenuity and people fight back against injustice and they make solutions. They create their own solutions.
I think that's really well said. You know, like if there's a thing I want written on my tombstone, it's this will all be so great if we don't screw it up. You know, we have this story about like technological utopians that say that the reason people were excited about the internet and wanted to make a free, fair, and open internet is because they hadn't even considered that it might all go wrong. And you know what? I know those people. I've been working for Electronic Frontier Foundation off and on since the early 2000s. And, you know, those people were never sanguine about the risks of technology. They wanted to have a movement to keep the internet free and open because they knew exactly how terrible it would be if our technology were suborned to the cause of oppressing us, and also how useful technology could be to opposing that oppression.
Well, Cory Doctorow, this collection of four novellas is Radicalized. I want to thank you for a terrific conversation about the book and about the issues that the book raises.
Well, thank you very much, too. I really appreciate it. I had a lovely time, as always.
Cory Doctorow. Find links to his blog, Crap Hound, and read an excerpt from Radicalized at writersvoice.net. Next up, we air our 2010 interview with Doctorow about his novel, Makers. That's coming up after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. During our first segment today, talking with science fiction novelist, blogger, and technology activist Cory Doctorow about his book Radicalized, we touched on the issue of digital rights management, or copyright, an issue that Doctorow has done extensive work around. He's been an opponent of digital rights management and an open source software activist. In 2010, we interviewed him about his novel Makers, which takes up these themes. Here's an edited version of that interview. Creative destruction. It's the term economist Joseph Schumpeter used to describe capitalism's power to transform the economy through radical innovation. The digital revolution is the latest example, revving up the pace of creative destruction to ever higher speeds. At the same time, it's leading to a blossoming of creativity through copying, using mashups and remixes to create new content out of old. My next guest, Cory Doctorow, he's co-editor of the blog Boing Boing, a major voice in the development of the cyberpunk subculture. Its themes are technology, futurism, science fiction, intellectual property, and Disney. All these themes are central to his book, Makers. Set in the near future of an America in decline, it's about two geeks in a garage who create a new economy based on backyard invention for the masses. The new work, as they call it, takes off with a mini startup in every abandoned strip mall in America. Then it crashes, a victim of its own success. The protagonists turn to building interactive amusement park rides, mashups and remixes of Disneyland. That gets the corporate giant on their tail. And therein lies the tale of the book. Makers is no anti-corporate screed. Doctorow has a nuanced take on capitalism that looks at all sides of the issues he explores.
I guess what I wanted to do was show in the round the different perspectives on creation and destruction and the imperfections of people who are involved in both creation and destruction. So, you know, you have a couple of executives for big multinational corporations whose oxes are getting pretty thoroughly gored, who for the most part act as you'd expect them to. They're not very happy about it and doing what they can to sabotage it, even though, you know, I think a lot of us would think of what they're doing as unethical or at least unfair. At the same time, you have people who are benefiting from the advent of this technology, who are at the center of this technology, who are kind of blinded to some of its downsides and whose own faults are put on display as well. And then you have finance people who, you know, on the one hand claim that they're just in it for the money, and on the other hand, eventually it becomes pretty clear that they're also in it because they're playing a game that makes themselves, that they find really satisfying, far in excess of what any kind of reasonable person would think of as the best thing for them to be doing. They're doing it because they're caught up in the excitement of it. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time lately thinking about the idea of market rationality and this fallacy, I think, that people act rationally in the marketplace. You know, that fallacy has obviously been put on great display with the latest economic collapse. But, you know, I wrote Makers about the economic collapse one or two before that one. I wrote it about the dot-com collapse, which I'd lived through in San Francisco, arriving just at the peak of it. I rented half an illegal sublet for $1,900 a month, and you know, I had it pretty good because the guy, my next door neighbor, was the guy living in the backyard in a Sears shed for $800 or $900 a month. He liked that apartment because it came with a parking place for his Jag. I mean, that's how irrational people are in booms. And you know, I think that having all these people who are caught up in the excitement of the thing really helped throw into relief that irrationality that's a fundamental character of how we conduct ourselves when we do these big important things that, you know, and we like to look back in hindsight and say, oh, you know, we did this because, you know, we were thinking about the good of the world or the good of our investors or because it was a hard and interesting technical question. But at the time, I think that what we're really doing it for is a lot more complicated and also maybe simpler, a lot more emotional.
As the book begins, This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with sci-fi writer Cory Doctorow about his new book, Makers. It's about the rise of a new kind of economy, one where meaning supplants money as a motivator. I asked Doctorow what he thought about the idea that with the digital revolution, all content wants to be free.
Well, so I think free is a very interesting concept. You know, Chris Anderson from Wired has this new book out about free, and I think it's generally a very good book. It's all about all the reasons that people do things for free and about all the ways that people are making money for free. But I think that at the risk of sounding a little kind of woolly-headed and info-hippie-ish, I think he focuses too much on the money. And the reason that he focuses too much on the money is that I think some of the things that people do for free not only don't exist in a market context, but wouldn't exist in a market context. There's a fair bunch of stuff that I would do for free that I wouldn't do for a small amount of money, but that I might do for a large amount of money. So, for example, this interview, right? If you'd said, you emailed me and said, I do this podcast, I don't make any money off of it, would you like to spend some time talking about it? And if you'd said, and I'll give you $10 for your time, I probably would have said no.
Right.
Because when I try to, you know, price that out against the realm of things that I charge money for, like paid lectures, $10 for an hour's worth of my time is actually a very bad trade for me to make. But instead, you approach it as a social transaction. And when you approach it as a social transaction, when money didn't come up at all, I said yes. And so there's this really large realm of things that exist outside of markets for important reasons and actually can't be marketified, right? So as soon as you try to pay people, for example, for writing blog posts about their personal lives, right? Now, there's lots of different kinds of blog posts. But say I propose to you, you know, I'd like your live journal in which you write about the things that are going on in your life and how they make you feel. I really like what you've been doing there. I'll pay you $3 a post from now on. And right now you're getting $0 a post, so I'm going to give you $3 a post. And that's a net profit of $3 opposed to you, even though $3 isn't very much. I predict that you wouldn't actually do very well with it, that you wouldn't write much, that what you did write wouldn't be as good, and that it wouldn't be nearly as fun or rewarding for you.
Yeah, and exactly. And it's contaminating the motivation, which has been pure on the one hand. It enters in something else that then you have to think about. And so you have different characters in the book who really embody some of these different approaches. And you also go into copyright. There's a certain point at which there's a battle that is drawn, that is brought, that mounts between Disney Corporation, which I think you took probably the most perfect corporation to embody this these ideas of copyright infringement and the big corporation going up against these small entrepreneurs. This is after the new work bubble has burst, and these two guys that you're talking about have still been making things. In fact, what they are making are rides that are the story of the new work boom when it occurred, which is an interesting concept in itself. So give us the outlines of this. Tell us what's going on.
Disney is, as you say, a very apt company to talk about this, but I think maybe for a slightly different reason than the one you had in mind. Disney is actually one of the most prolific examples and most impressive examples of how good remix culture can be. Disney doesn't have a lot of original ideas. What it has is a lot of original ways of reusing ideas that already existed, right? So taking bits and pieces of folk tales or much loved stories and making new things out of them. I mean, for a great example of that, just look at Alice in Wonderland, which has just come out, and they're doing a lovely job reinterpreting one of my very favorite stories. It's probably not a coincidence that my wife is called Alice. And I think that everybody who does that is prone to a kind of exceptionalism that says, what I'm doing is art, but when you do it to me, it's theft. And it takes a fair degree of intellectual honesty for someone to go, actually, when I did it, it was art, and now that you're doing it to me, it's art too. Usually it doesn't matter, because usually, you know, the people who claim that they're possessed of some mystic originality, and that everyone else, you know, and that the way that they, when they reuse things, it has this characteristic of mystic originality, and everybody else is a mere derivative maker. Usually those claims are kind of irrelevant because they don't go anywhere. It's you know, they don't have a lot of market power. They can't get new laws passed and so on. But Disney actually does pass new laws. Disney has really powerful lawyers. Disney has a really powerful influence over society. And the way that Disney conducts itself has actually tilted the board so that what Disney did the first time around, no one else can then go and do to them. This is what I mean when I say every pirate dreams of being an admiral. That here you have Disney, which was only too happy to be thoroughgoing, sticky-fingered takers of culture and remakers of culture, characterizing everybody who comes after them as a thief. And so in the book, you have characters who are these characters who've built this kind of museum that's a tribute to the things that they built and they loved and they lost. And it allows anyone to bring in the things that they built and loved and lost and add it to the museum. It's a kind of cooperative museum. And people who are involved in a Disney project start to add this stuff to it. And Disney uses this as a pretense to chase them down using trademark law and copyright law. And because they're so out-lawyered, it's somewhat a successful tactic. And I think that this has a lot of parallels to reality. I think you do see today companies that have a lot of money and lawyers using the law and using their influence to stop anyone from coming along and doing what they did when they were getting started.
And on the free download site that you have for this book, Makers, Cory Doctorow, I'm going to quote what you say there at the beginning of this. This isn't part of your book, but it's a preface here on the website. There's a dangerous group of anti-copyright activists out there who pose a clear and present danger to the future of authors and publishing. They have no respect for property or laws. What's more, they're powerful and organized and have the ears of lawmakers and the press. So is Disney would be one of these anti-copyright activists?
Yeah, I think so. In as much as copyright recognizes two important things. The first is that people who buy copyrighted works own those works, right? Your parents can pass down their books to you. You can loan out books. You can loan out the DVDs that you own. You can borrow them. You can take them out of the library. You can sell them when you're done with them. You can buy used books and movies and music and so on if you want to get a start on it. And yet there's an enormous amount of energy being put into figuring out how to stop people, but using both law and technology, from being able to do that. And I think that this is actually deadly. I think that this is a deadly practice.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're playing an edited version of our 2010 interview with speculative fiction author and technology activist Cory Doctorow about his novel Makers. When it came out, Doctorow made it available as a free download under the Creative Commons license. I asked him about that. You know, most people think about copyright as protecting the artist's right to make money. You give away your book and you have a family, you need to support them. So how do you square your need to make a living with your willingness, your even eagerness to give your book away free in certain forms?
Well, let me, before I answer that, talk about what most people think copyright is for. Most copyright scholars, no matter what side of the world they're in, you know, and most copyright lawyers would not say that the point of copyright in the United States is for artists to make money. If that's its point, it's not doing a very good job. I mean, let's be frank here. And you know, it's not clear how copyright alone actually does that job. I mean, say you gave poets a million years of copyright and you also gave them like a copyright axe that they could use to chop off the hands of anyone who copied a poem without permission. It's not obvious to me how that would make poets any more money. A little bit of copyright may help some people make money, but copyright itself is no guarantee that an artist will make money, even if they make art that people want to consume. And what copyright is for, what the Progress Clause of the American Constitution sets out the purpose of copyright as being for, is to promote the arts, right? That is to say that if we give creators some exclusive rights, it may incentivize the creation of more works. Now, they don't. The framers of the Constitution did not say that this is the only way to do it, nor did they say that Congress must do it. They said Congress may do it. Congress may create exclusive rights regimes in order to promote the useful arts and sciences, not in order to enrich artists, but in order to promote the arts. So in terms of how I make a living from this stuff, I don't think that Creative Commons costs me money. I think Creative Commons makes me money. For me, the case for using Creative Commons commercially is pretty straightforward. It's what Tim O'Reilly says, that for most artists, the problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity, that the majority of artists, of audience members who fail to buy one of my books today do so because they never heard of it, not because someone offered them a free copy electronically. So as a result, even though maybe some sales are displaced, more sales are generated. And I think that this is true up and down the kind of food chain of the creative arts. People who are very, very, very popular, for whom piracy, obscurity isn't a problem. The experience of those people who've experienced a lot of piracy is that it barely eats into their income, that they already have a lot of income. And, you know, like progressive taxation, it only takes a small nibble out of a very, very large pie. For the people that no one's ever heard of, chances are nobody cares about their work enough to steal it. So they don't really have any piracy problem. And, you know, certainly that seems to be the experience of most people who use Creative Commons licenses, is that in and of themselves, while they do magnify any love that people feel for your work because they can share it with other people and kind of evangelize it to them, it doesn't generate any love for your work in and of itself. It doesn't make people want to run out and get your work just because it's there. And then for the middle class, say, the people who are moderately well-known and have some mechanism whereby it can make their works can be well-known. So, you know, I've got a publisher. My publisher does all the things publishers do to make works well-known. That Creative Commons generates some sales, more sales than it displaces. And so that's the commercial case for it. But I think there's an important artistic and ethical case to be made for it too. You know, artistically, it's the 21st century. I think it's implausible to think that copying is going to get any harder at all, ever. You know, hard drives aren't going to get more expensive and have lower capacities and be bulkier. Networks aren't going to get harder to use and slower. We're not going to get a smaller population of people who know how to Google and go to Google and type in, you know, Batman Returns BitTorrent. So from now on, copying only gets easier. And so if you're making art that you don't intend to have copied in the 21st century, I don't think you're making contemporary art. I think you're making anachronistic art. And, you know, I think it's cool that someone out there wants to be the blacksmith at Pioneer Village, and more power to them. But that's not my gig. You know, I'm a science fiction writer. I should at least be grappling with the present, even if not the future. And then morally, you know, I'm a copyist, you're a copyist, everyone I know is a copyist. When I go and give talks about copyright at big companies, including Disney, and I say, is there anyone in this room who isn't a copyright infringer? No one puts their hands up. You know, Disney's copyright lawyers know well enough about copyright law to know that they can't stick their hands up when I say, are you not a copyright infringer? Everybody's a copyright infringer. So running around and getting up on my high horse about copyright infringement just reeks of hypocrisy to me. And moreover, you know, copying is how I think most creative people got their starts. You know, my first story was when I was 6 years old. I'd come home from Star Wars and it was fizzing in my brain, and I went and I got all the paper in the house and stapled it into something the shape of a paperback book and rewrote the Star Wars story as I understood it. Just like if you go through Florence, you'll find in every corner someone's statue of the David, because for 500 years the way that you became a sculptor in Florence is by taking the best sculpture you could find and copying it until you understood how it worked. Mm-hmm. So I think going around and telling would-be creators, especially kids, this corrosive lie that creativity doesn't involve enthusiastic, unpermitted, unauthorized copying at great velocity and with great verve, I think that really does a disservice to creativity itself. And it also, I think, short-circuits kids' intuition about how creativity works, because I think intuitively everybody understands that the way you create is by starting by copying. You know, copying is really hardwired into us. We copy the way that we nuzzle for the breast, and it's not a coincidence, because, you know, the origin of life is when some 3 to 4 billion years ago, molecules figured out how to copy themselves through a process we don't understand very well. We are descended from things that figured out how to copy. Things that didn't figure out how to copy don't have descendants, right? That's what having descendants is. It's figuring out how to copy stuff. So I think that by approaching Creative Commons licenses, by affirming the ethical and artistic merits of copying that I do things that make my art better and make my ethics better. And, you know, lucky for me, it also makes my bottom line better. It sells a lot of books. You know, for an example, the book Before Makers, the one that's been out for a while, Little Brother, is a New York Times bestseller, 90,000 hardcovers in print, sold into 17 languages and 18 markets, film rights sold to the guy who made Natural Born Killers and Transformers, theatrical adaptation on in Chicago, and there's a bunch of inquiries to mount it in other cities. It's done very well by me. And that book was available in stores as a free download right at the same time that available on the internet as free download right at the same time as it was available in stores.
Wow, that's a great example. Now, I'm just so curious, why did Disney invite you to talk with them?
Oh, because I'm a total Disney fanboy. My first novel was set in Walt Disney World. It was called Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom. I've written a long novella set there called There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow that's based on the Carousel of Progress ride. I blog about Disney all the time. A friend of mine who works in Imagineering says that one of the ways that you know that someone at Disney is cool is if you work there, is if you go into their office and you see my book, Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom, on their bookshelf, you know that it's one of the cool people who work at Disney. So, you know, I've got lots of things to say to them because I think they make good stuff.
Writer Cory Doctorow. In addition to Makers, he's the author of the novel Little Brother, among others, and several story collections. His blog is craphound.com. You can find a link to the digital copy of Makers at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. That was our 2010 interview with Cory Doctorow about his novel Makers. Go to writersvoice.net for links to his writing about digital copyright and the internet. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Paul Tough about his important new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. It's an examination of how the higher education system is rigged to preserve income inequality while selling the myth of meritocracy to all. It also explores what some colleges and universities are doing to level the playing field of access. Make sure to tune in. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.